Hello, everybody. Thank you for joining us on Alien Talk Podcast. This is the show where we discuss all things about aliens and UFOs, and as always, where we push the limits of our understanding. We are your inquisitive, truth-seeking, and fact-chasing co-hosts, Joe Landry and Roy Olford. And as of 1 month ago, we are co-authors of a brand new science fiction novel that is titled Battle Planet AD, Relic of the Gods. And we're obviously very proud of it. We took a lot of time to write it and work on the storyline and refine the plot and all of its characters. And it's something we envisioned in our minds for quite a while, and something of which we put a lot of planning in. So today we want to go into a little bit about what motivated and inspired us to create this novel, and really along with that, this podcast, right, Lori? All of it began with just you and I talking about the ancient astronaut theory while we were on long night shifts at work and bouncing ideas around.
Yeah, that's right. We both found that we had a common interest in Zachariah Sitchin's book series, The Earth Chronicles, and that got us thinking about how we can share some of the ideas we formulated about how ancient history, particularly that which pertains to the Bible, is full of stuff that suggests there was a significant extraterrestrial presence. So you and I wanted to get other people to start thinking more deeply about these religious and scriptural topics, just as we were. And that's when we came up with the idea to present it as a novel that was both entertaining and thought-provoking. And we wanted to take a concept of the ancient alien theory and set it as the backdrop for a story that ties in with the modern-day UFO narrative.
Right. So if you remember from our very first podcast episode that we aired almost 3 years ago now, you and I explained how some of our own personal life experiences led us to ponder and to question a lot of what we were taught to believe in. And when we examined our faith more closely, we found that there were things that were very problematic, that just didn't make sense and didn't satisfy a reasonable standard of objective truth. However, after juxtaposing some of these aspects of the Christian religion and the Bible against the basic premise of extraterrestrial intelligence and the notion that humanity had at one time or may still be in contact with aliens, and certainly from ancient times, we found that there were possible answers to some of these mysteries, some of the obscurities. So we want to revisit that theme from our first show. But we also want to put it into the context of a discussion about our book, as well as what brought the idea of it into existence for us.
Yeah, and I'm sure there are a lot of you listening right now that could possibly relate, especially if you've been raised in the church like we have, and some of you probably have been ministers in different areas of the church like we have. And we're not doing an episode where we're trying to peddle our book. We want to promote the narrative and explain where we're coming from in writing this novel, which in some ways may be controversial. Maybe a lot of ways it'll be controversial, but some people may find it as such. So, because it does challenge the reader to take a different perspective on their personal faith, it may encourage some to ask the same questions that you and I have asked, Joe, as well as many others who have.
I've always thought that was important to do, to ask questions. Even when I was big into Christian apologetics, I believe that you benefit from occasionally taking off your denominational glasses and contemplating ideas that may even go completely against your deepest beliefs. And also, it's important to study the Bible from a different standpoint than you were taught throughout your life in your church and through your upbringing. That kind of critical thinking is important to better understand what you believe and why you believe it. And even if you don't agree with it, no one is ever saying that you have to agree with it, or at least they should never, shouldn't be saying that that you must agree with it. But I think that that sort of honest intellectual journey of the self brings about more comfort with your own spirituality, because you know that genuine inquisitiveness is nothing to fear. Doubt is nothing to fear. It is what leads you to obtain true and verifiable knowledge, whatever that knowledge may actually hold.
Yeah, exactly. So this all began, this quest to write a book, a little over 5 years ago now. It was right after you told me that you published your book, The Gnostic's Fire, which is a novel, a supernatural sort of mystery novel. And I remember that we were talking about you publishing or your publishing experience with Exebris and how I was thinking that it seemed to be a lot less of a headache than what I went through with page publishing. But it got me thinking about a trilogy, about how we could turn all that we learned from reading Eric Von Daniken and Zachariah Sitchin books into a fantasy story, something like a sci-fi film.
Right. Well, and actually went a little further back than that. So you and I worked together for a few years before we got our books published. We had been on many calls together. We were in the same division on the east side of town. You and I were both with patrol operations for years. And you were with the agency for quite a while before I was and became a detective before I did. And then you went back on the streets for a few years before retiring last December. And anyway, it was in July of 2016 that I overheard your conversation on the phone with someone while you were in the briefing room at our police station. And I walked in and overheard part of it. And you were telling whoever it was on the other end about a book that you said you were getting published. And that struck my interest. I was like, because at the time I was also working on a manuscript for a book. So after you got off the phone, I asked if I heard you correctly saying that you published a book. And that's when you told me about Let Us Descend, the biblical first contact.
Right. And the person I was talking to, I had no idea who it was. I can't remember for the life of me who that was, but I know that a lot of people heard about the book and they were asking questions about it and they were calling me up, asking me, you know, to tell them about it and why I wrote it, and because it was very controversial and a lot of Christians hated it and the church didn't like it, that's for sure. And I was trying to, you know, explain how, you know, you can still be a Christian and believe in the ancient alien theory. And that's how I explained it in the book. After that, we got into more discussions about the 12th planet by Sitchin and how the Sumerian narratives about the Anunnaki and the biblical account of the Hebrew God seem to be describing things that could easily be interpreted as extraterrestrial encounters. So we found out that we were in agreement about a lot of these things and learned that, you know, we came from similar religious backgrounds in Christian ministry and church participation, as we mentioned to everyone in our first episode. But anyway, after that point in time, you got your book published after that.
Well, yeah, as it was, after seeing that you got your book finished in 2016, that inspired me to press on with mine. I started writing The Gnostic's Fire in 2014. And it dragged. I mean, it really dragged. book writing, it takes a long time because you run into periods of what they call writer's block. And of course, you know, we have full-time jobs and families, and that takes our time too. So it's not like you can devote 100% every day like a full-time employment when you're writing a book. You kind of do it in spurts. And sometimes those spurts come quickly, and other times you go for weeks or even months without any kind of real creativity flowing through you, and the manuscript just kind of sits on the flash drive, and you don't even touch it. And you know, for a while, I was actually thinking of the title, The Gnostic Stone, and I thought that sounded a little too much like something from Harry Potter. And then I went with The Gnostic's Talisman, and I was sticking with that for almost up to the time the manuscript was finalized, and I decided I didn't like that, and I went with The Gnostic's Fire, and that's what it's published under. And really, about the time when I found out about your book, I was starting to really wonder about just quitting and it's not writing anymore and just giving up on continuing that book. So after I saw that you completed it and it was a final product, that really motivated me to do the same. And so I went ahead and finished The Gnostic's Fire. A little over 2 years later, it was in December of 2018, and I think I ordered your first, one of your first copies that were sold, that were available, of Let Us Descend. Now, most people don't know this, but you had a slightly different title at the initial publication, so I guess I can say I have like a collector's edition of your book.
Right. Well, at first I went with Omitimus Descendum, the biblical first contact, and I wanted to use the Latin phrase for let us descend, but eventually found out that that was not working out so great for the Google search engine and ended up being the wrong interpretation. So a little embarrassing, but about a year later, I changed it. But yeah, in early 2019, we talked about co-authoring a trilogy and got right to work on the first book, which is this one, The Battle Planet AD. And we agreed upon writing this book as a fictional account to the ancient alien theory. And it's divided up into three parts. And the first being something like a space opera told to, you know, have been happening some 4,000 years ago in ancient Africa and the Middle East. And the other two being the main body of the story, which is actually set in 1947, hint, hint. And that's where our primary characters are introduced, and it takes on the genre of an action-adventure saga from there.
Yeah, and I just want to say, I think Omitimus Descendum is a cool title. I mean, I like the Latin phrase there. I thought that was really cool, but I understand. Yeah, it probably doesn't work out so great on the Google search engine. But it means the same thing. Minimus descendum is Latin for let us descend. But it's no coincidence that the main story of our book takes place in 1947. That is the year of the Roswell incident. And it associates that it's a real occurrence with a lot of literary embellishment and fabrication, as we are novelists. And with one another that is told to happen in Egypt during the same time frame. There's another storyline that, you know, like two sub stories going together. One's happening in Egypt during the same time frame in 1947. And that first part of the novel is like a precursor. And as you said, it takes place in the ancient world, but here there is an immediate and parallel connection from that into the second part, which is the crash, which is the time during the crash of Roswell happens, and there's a concurrent archaeological discovery made in Egypt. So both are tied to one another, to the events of the first part, come together in the third part as the two protagonists are introduced to each other and embark on a special mission, a quest. And that is where the entire picture is revealed, and the whole theme of the story then starts to become known.
Yeah, the whole thing begins with an aerial battle that was going on with alien ships set back during the time of the biblical story of Sodom and Gomorrah, but also at the same time, the Hindu story of Mohenjo-Daro. So there's a connection there between those two cities, which probably are the same. But both accounts from ancient texts talk about destruction of the cities in a manner that seems to be nothing less than thermonuclear explosions. And the book of Genesis describes fire and brimstone falling upon Sodom and Gomorrah, and how Lot's wife turned into a pillar of salt simply by looking at the cities being destroyed while at a distance away from them. And the Mahabharata, the Hindu text, has huge flying palaces shaped like pyramids that could move about the sky and rain down fire. And there is an obvious connection there, as they both are talking about a fiery annihilation coming down from above. And we took our story from the book of Genesis and created it and told it a separate version about the God side of things, and how it could be that they orchestrated the destruction from their spaceships in orbit above the Earth.
Yeah, and we were able to see, you know, with this, the opportunity to write our own story about that. Like you said, we took a lot of material from the book of Genesis and sort of, you know, made our own little story out of it, and about what's, you know, talked about in our religious traditions and being related to ancient aliens. But we didn't want to just make it all about ancient aliens. We wanted to bring it in line with modern day UFO stories, and also make it seem not so much, you know, as forced or cliche. We didn't want to talk all about, you know, modern day UFOs and all about ancient aliens. So we wanted to somehow forge them together into like one well-stitched storyline. So, of course, the Roswell part is one of the most, you know, that story is one of the most famous accounts of extraterrestrial encounters from our time. So we wanted to use that to bring the theory of ancient aliens into something most everyone has heard of, and certainly make the story unique with our own characters and sets of dynamics. And the reference to Roswell is really the only thing in it that's based on a true event. Everything else is completely fictional. And really, even the sub-story surrounding Roswell and all of its material, it's stuff that we created from the liberty of our imaginations, right?
Yeah, we created it from our imagination. But I mean, if you're at the faith to believe that the stories of God in the Bible are true, then I guess you can say it would be true to a point, I guess, from a certain point of view. I don't know. But that's why, you know, it is fiction. It's a science fiction / historical fiction. And what we do is some of the names, and if you read the book, they're not misspelled. We decided to use the names as if the gods were like, this is how the gods would have spelled the names to Abraham and to Lot. So they're spelled differently. That was done purposely. So on purpose. And it sums up the whole human quest for understanding our origins. The opening line on our back cover synopsis is, the quest for our future lies in our past. So simply put, the answers to who we will be as a world civilization to come are found through learning about what happened to us in our past. And the main part of the book is really about that. One of the characters, the main character, Stephen Marshall, he's a U.S. Army Air Corps officer who investigates the UFO crash at Roswell, and he's ordered by the Pentagon to meet up with Samuel Crowley, and he's a British archaeologist who discovers an astonishing artifact in Egypt, who in turn is ordered by his government to further study what he uncovered there. And those are the main characters, and the two of them sort of together represent the desire in everyone to find the truth about our existence in the universe, the ever-present questions of who we are, why are we here, and what is our destiny?
Exactly. That puts it pretty succinctly. Samuel represents the intellectual curiosity and the inquisitiveness of humanity and a desire to explore and be receptive to new ideas and new possibilities, no matter how much they challenge what we already know and believe about ourselves and the world we live in. Stephen, on the other hand, he sort of embodies our struggle in accepting change and a hesitancy to break away from all the dogmas and the rules and the traditions that, you know, we've been taught and brought up in. And even when there is an emptiness to those notions and beliefs, we have a tendency to hold on to them. And Stephen sort of represents that side of the human experience. So the character arcs of both Samuel and Stephen bring them to the awareness of our place in the universe and what is to come in the future. And they reach this by an understanding that aliens have been here on Earth and that they will come back to Earth again, possibly sooner than anyone can possibly fathom. And those aliens are the gods from our religions, and the mythologies about those gods are nothing more than the record of the aliens being here on Earth. The very Anunnaki has told and is preserved in the ancient Sumerian tradition, like we mentioned from our readings of Zachariah Sitchin and Eric Von Daniken.
Correct. Now, it's no secret at this point that the archaeological relic that is discovered is the wreckage of an alien spaceship. And we decided to go with this because we know that many monuments have been discovered under the sands of Egypt and in the foliage of Central America. So what if one day an actual spaceship is discovered beneath a pyramid or found buried in the sand or soils of the world? Not a glyph or an etching, but a real deal piece of ET machinery. How will that affect us? How will it change us, particularly in our beliefs about God and fate? Based on what we just described here with the beginning of the book and parts of going through the book, we're going to read a portion of the chapter detailing this account where, you know, the gods are, discussing the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. So I'm going to read from page 80, bottom of page 80, and to wherever I stop here. So anyway, so here it goes. Meanwhile, far out in space on the flagship, Enlil and Minister Urdu stand on the observation platform of the busy command bridge while discussing matters. Commander Om walks over to them to give a status update. The regional bases are reporting in with their headcounts, and we have the shuttles standing by, he spoke efficiently. We still are waiting for the logistical sorties on the surface to finish the needed mobility protocol. What about the local governors, Enlil inquired. Have they relayed their evacuation procedures for all those who are under them? They have, my lord, Om answered and then hesitated. But we still have yet to receive any word from Prince Enki, although the disassembly process in Kanan tends to be a little more complicated than in other regions. I'm sure it won't be much longer. Enlil's expression was consternated. What about the attack ships? Are they in the final stage of preparation? Yes, sir. They are at 80% of full strength. They are all in standby orbit with designated armament being uploaded. They will be ready to move into position once the order is given. Enki is a fool if he thinks the king and I are not serious about this. I'll blast that planet to pieces, even with him on it. He is silent for a few seconds while he scans out the window, out at the glowing blue earth. Let's begin a hard countdown. Let's sit it for T-minus 48, as you wish, my lord. Wait, one more thing. Yes, sir. Enlil struggled with his feelings, pondering his inner conflict of both burning anger towards his brother and at the same time, deep affection. Send the shuttle down there now. I'm not going to give Enki a chance to drag his feet with this, and I'm not going to allow him to try to become a martyr in the eyes of my father. I personally want him off the surface immediately. Won't you need to go there yourself? Urdu spoke up. After all, no one else other than the king has the authority to make him leave, as you say. Neither the king nor I have time to go descend there and do that, Enlil replied. One of our security detachments will be given their orders directly from me to use force, if need be, to get him onto the ship. Perhaps I can be of help, came a low voice from behind them. The three of them turned to look. Ninma was standing elegantly at the opposite end of the platform. I will go to the surface and talk to Enki. Their sister, Enlil began to say, the situation below is quite precarious right now. Why, it's even worse than the last time they rebelled. They're more vicious and bloodthirsty. I wouldn't feel right seeing you go there. You know very well that if anything happens to Enki at your bidding, our father would be highly angered with you, she answered. Enlil looked at Urdu, who in return gave an expression showing his agreement with her. He will listen to me, Ninma continued. If I go there, he will certainly be persuaded to not dally at the king's command. Enki has never been able to say no to me. A tinge of jealousy came across Enlil as he heard Ninma speak flirtingly and affectionately about Enki, becoming somewhat entranced by the sight of her extraordinary charm. Nima's brilliant aqua blue eyes, radiant glowing complexion, and long flowing black hair all accentuated her perfect femininity. Indeed, she was the embodiment of beauty. Perhaps you're correct, Enlil said quickly, regaining his attentiveness. The king would hold me accountable for any calamity that might befall my foolhardy brother if he were not to comply with my men acting on orders from me. Ninma gave him a seductive and alluring smile, which again made him lose his train of thought. Very well, he snapped. Commander Om, see to it that the princess is escorted to whichever transport shuttle was being sent to Sector 7. Right away, sir, he answered. Then looked over at Ninma. Your Highness, if you will, please follow me.
Okay, so that part that you read there, that is from... like I said, it's three parts. That is the first part. That is the space opera part. And it does sound indeed like space opera. The names and the descriptions, the sort of military sort of style to it. They're about to do an attack from space. And if it sounds like ancient alien stuff, is because that's what it's meant to sound like. The first part of the book is just that. It is the ancient aliens on Earth. And what they're talking about is what we see in the book of Genesis, okay? And with Sodom and Gomorrah being destroyed the way it is. And when we read that account, you know, the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah does very much sound, in terms of, you know, the description, like a thermonuclear blast. Like you said before, or even the details with Lot's wife turning to a pillar of salt. That's a strange sort of description. That's a strange way to put it, pillar of salt. Obviously, she perished just simply from looking at the destruction of the cities. And we know from modern day use of nuclear weapons testing that you can't look at it. You have to be extremely far away. And even if you put your hands over your eyes to cover your eyes from the blast of the nuclear explosion, the radiation from it is so powerful that it'll actually penetrate the flesh of your hands and still blind you. So looking at it is dangerous. Looking at it can actually, depending on how far away you are, can kill you. And we've seen that with, you know, even the stories from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that people, you know, far away from the nuclear blast still died just from the exposure to it. So this sounds a lot like that. I mean, we don't know for sure. It you know, doesn't say it's a nuclear explosion, but it kind of has that similar sort of in description. So what we're doing here is putting that into the context of a new story, and that being that Sodom and Gomorrah actually are being destroyed by thermonuclear weapons deployed by the Anunnaki being this alien race who is present on Earth at this time in Earth's past. So this part of the book is really not the main story. This is sort of the fore story. And it kind of sets the tone about Earth's history, as many of us know, is, you know, told from ancient astronaut theory, like as read in, as we find from reading Zachariah Sitchin and Eric von Daniken. So that was a good take on it there, Laurie.
Yeah, thanks. And well, as you just heard, I mean, that's what we are asking. Like, could it be possible that a discussion like this occurred 4,000 plus years ago? And we have the stories that are told to us, like you said, in Genesis and Earth. So, you know, with Earth, there had to have been, you know, a spaceship or something up above the earth for it to occur as described in Genesis. The whole, you know, the whole fire and brimstone, like we've said before, like if God is God, you know, with the capital G, and he's the omnipotent and ever-present being, and, you know, and he created everything into existence by speaking it, why couldn't he just speak it out of existence? Why does fire and brimstone have to come down from the heavens to destroy these cities? And the same example is true for the Tower of Babel story. I mean, we have the biblical conversation about God talking to other gods, about going down to see the tower. You know, if he's already this omnipotent being and he's everywhere present, shouldn't he already seen the tower? Shouldn't he already know about the tower? So, I mean, what about that conversation? And how, where, and when did, you know, did it take place? So we have this type of situation arise with a university professor named Samuel Crowley, who realizes that a discovery like this will indeed change the course of history. And that discovery is this relic that is of the gods, this spaceship. And then that's when this discovery is connected to another discovery, which is in Roswell, New Mexico. Hint, hint. Now, this is where we have the British intelligence officers meeting up with the U.S. Air Force in an attempt to gain the secrets of the crashed ships. And, of course, a religious group arises claiming the ship to be a holy vessel of God. So you can see where the similarities are with how things unfold today with, you know, these types of discoveries. And, I mean, we mentioned it just the last episode with the whole Baltic Sea anomaly. Like, that could very well be a crashed spaceship at the bottom of the Baltic Sea. But yet we're not going to know about that because the powers that be will keep that information from getting out to us. They're not going to admit that that's what it is. It's similar to how, you know, the Muslims adore the Bin Bin stone, which is, you know, a meteorite, but they circle around that thing and they worship it. But and this is where we went with this cabal of or whatever. And now we're going to read a portion of a conversation between the ancient gods. We just read a portion of the ancient gods that led up to the imminent attack on Sodom and Gomorrah. But I'm going to read at the governor Marduk, which is on page 44. And soon a human enters and bows on page a human enters and bows on page 46. So give me a minute here to find page 44. Okay. While Governor Marduk and Commander Om await the royal arrival, down on the surface, Enki, Anu's other son and the half-brother of Enlil, walks out onto one of the porticos on the north wall of the immense palace in southern Africa. From there, he looks out to the lush mountains that are miles beyond the jungle, where he sees the cumbersome machinery moving about the myriad of mineshafts. He is deep in his thoughts for several minutes, so much so that he initially doesn't hear Kenan, one of his advisors, come onto the portico from the open door. Lord Enki, sir, he repeatedly said. Your Highness, finally snapping out of his daydream, Enki turns around to see him. I'm sorry to bother you, my lord, but Abraham has arrived and wishes to speak with us. I believe he may have some important information concerning the incursions. Enki, who stands at a staggering 12 feet in height, nods to him. Yes, I suppose he does, he said in a sobering tone. Indeed, said Kegan, the situation is quite precarious. You know, Enlil will be eager to find any reason to bring swift and brutal retaliation, and that's why we need to take a stand and appeal to the king's more calculated nature. He will hear you out. You are his son. He has always shown more favor to Enlil with everything, Enki grumbled. Perhaps, but he cannot deny your greatness, my lord, seeing what you have done for the betterment of our mission here. Without you, there would be no biogenesis, and our gold productions would be a third of what it is. Truly, and it would be our people who would be revolting against him instead of the Adamu. At the very least, he has to glorify me for that. Enki paused for a few seconds, then said, Have Abraham meet us in my chamber. I do wish to hear what he has to say. The two of them walked through the palace and then entered a large and lavish room, and soon a human enters and bows.
We don't want to give away too much of the plot either.
Right.
and really, the plot is actually pretty complex. So what we're doing now, this is when we decided we're going to create this story, that we had to have, something to set the stage. And the ancient alien theory is what's setting the stage. So that is what the first section of the book is. It's setting the stage. And it's this first six chapters, I believe, is part one. And that describes, the alien race, the Anunnaki, the gods from Nibiru. Where we do reference the planet Nibiru in that part. But the real meat of the story comes in part two. Okay. And that's when we meet Professor Dr. Samuel Crowley. Okay. And that's when we're in the year 1947. So now we're taking on to the main part of the story, and this is where we wanted to get into the meaning of it, is where, people's desire to know the truth and our, push for discovery. And that's exactly what happens here. A great discovery is made. And this is always something I wondered, and we even had an episode about this a while ago. It was about spaceports on Earth, and the question was, if this alien race was here, why don't we see more of their hardware? Why don't we actually come across like a wrecked spacecraft? Well, in this novel, that's exactly what happens. They come across a wrecked spacecraft. Crowley and his crew are on a dig out in Egypt, to the west of Cairo, and they come across a spacecraft, and it's no doubt a UFO. And Crowley recognizes immediately that this shouldn't be here. Okay, this is a piece of technology that just does not belong buried in the sands of Egypt, where the other things that they're finding are 4,000 years old. It's just out of place. So he knows what they found was a huge discovery, that is going to change our understanding of archaeology and human history. So again, we don't want to get too much into the plot. We don't want to give it all away. But this concurrently happens with the reference to the Roswell story. That's where other protagonist, Stephen, who is, like you said, he's an army officer. He's at Roswell Air Base, and now he's going to investigate the crash. Now, this really, like I said, this is the one part of the story where it's based on a factual event, but the details and the names, the actual layout of events, that is not the same. This is not the official Roswell story that you're going to find in here. This is a fabricated story, but the only thing that is, you know, factual is the name Roswell and the incident that happened there. Everything else, we took the liberty of using our own imaginations to come up with different names, different set of conversations and everything like that. And really the whole storyline out of that is completely changed. Right, Lori?
Right. Yeah, it is. And well, we'll read, we'll read a little, just probably a page here, I think a page or two, in reference to the discovery.
Right. That's a good what probably is finding, because this is really kind of the aha moment. This is where he finds the smoking gun that all of us, you know, want to see. We want to see the proof.
Right. So it begins with on page 108. I found something, came the shout. Quickly, the others helped to brush the dirt off what had been hit. They stood up in befuddlement as they saw an object of similar color as the other one, but long and cylindrical in shape, with tubes and wires coming from the side. I say, it looks like something from an airplane, like from an airplane landing gear, one of them exclaimed. Crowley's face became flushed, and he started to tremble slightly. It's not from an airplane, he huddled monotonically. Not from an airplane? Then what in God's name is it from? Look, Henry said, these tubes and wire things go on in this direction. There's more connected to it. Crowley scanned the ground surrounding the nearby dug test pit with a stiff face. Keep digging that way, he ordered, pointing. Let's try to expose more. Feverishly, they dig in the direction where the tubes and wire run in the buried soil. And with every few feet, they come upon similar objects, all with wires and tubes coming from them. Soon, they hit a large piece, something like a structure. We have something big here. It seems to be this way to the left, someone shouted. Everyone paused with their eyes affixed to what was exposed from underneath millennia of sand, which looked like an aircraft's wing edge. By now, dusk was approaching, and soon the sun would be setting. Crowley pulled out an anchor shift and wiped the sweat from his brow, staring at the structure as if in a trance. He knew there was something big in the ground, but he knew he had to be right before telling the world and needing as much conversation or confirmation as possible. My friends, he began to speak with a tone of both fear and invigoration, we may very well be on the threshold of history tonight. What we will soon discover on this excavation may surpass your wildest imaginations. If it is what I believe it truly is, then the entire course of humanity is about to be forever altered. Every religion known to man has attempted to connect us with the gods and their heavenly realms. This will be that very connection. This is not from ancient man or modern man. This is from the gods.
Right. So this part here is sort of the foundation. This is the nexus that joins the ancient alien story that is in part one with the main part of the story. This is the discovery that gets the entire thing moving, because it's based on this that the whole story is centered. And from this point, we, as the plot continues to move on, we see, you know, parallel stories between Samuel's experience with what he's finding right now, and also with Stephen's experience with the Roswell incident. They come together essentially, like you said earlier, the two governments want these two individuals to become part of a team, and that is meant to more or less secure the interest of Western governments on the claim to this discovery. And that's sort of what drives the entire, that's the impetus for everything to get in motion, is that the two governments, the British government and the U.S. government, realize that something very important that will change the course of human history has been found, and it needs to be secured. So it wouldn't be a novel if there wasn't some conflict, right? Or some tension. There has to be an antagonist, and there is an antagonist. You brought it up before, that cabal. So this cabal, Ori, what do you have to say about the cabal?
Yeah, so this cabal is the Brotherhood of the Serapis. And these are an ancient, they're Gnostics, I believe, as how we described them. And they are the ones that are trying to keep this discovery from falling into the hands of the government officials. And this is where it gets violent because they are very religious to their core. And they believe that this ancient ship is actually the ship of God. So, like I said, it's almost like, you know, we're taking the story of like how they love the Benben stone. They worship that. And now this ship that is a relic of the gods, they believe that this is an actual spaceship, but not spaceship in our minds, but they can't see past the religiousness of this thing. When they see God, that this is a vehicle of God, they don't see that it's a vehicle, that it was made by the gods being flesh and blood. All they see is God. This is from God. So from here, this is where the whole story takes, a violent turn, but I can't give much detail about that right now.
Okay, so this is the part where there's conflict. Okay.
Yeah.
And the conflict is you have the team that Stephen and Samuel are part of. And that is the practical scientific endeavor. That is the political endeavor. This is the spiritual endeavor, this cabal of the Brotherhood of Serapis. And they're closely associated with the Coptic Church in Egypt. And Coptics are Christians. But this special group that we're talking about actually incorporates all mythology, not only Christianity, but also the religion of ancient Egypt into the dogma of their belief in God. So, like you said, this is something like the Kaaba of Islam or the Benben stone of Islam. And it's holy. It comes from the gods. And it's something that is not meant to be examined or tampered with. It's something that's meant to be worshipped and protected. And that's exactly what they want to do. So that's where the tension comes in. And yes, it does take a violent turn. There are other things that prelude all this. They have to make a little side trip into British Mandate Palestine before they actually go into Egypt. Looking back, we actually made a pretty complex plot with a lot of sub stories that go along with this. And quite a few characters were introduced in the telling of this entire novel, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's quite a few. There's several British intelligence agents that join, that join the quest. And there's a couple of these other, I don't know what you would call them. The European type agency?
giving away a lot here, but the French Liberation Committee. That was a real organization that existed sometime in the early 20th century. It's more or less a archaeological organization, and they existed to preserve a lot of Egypt's heritage and also to spearhead a lot of archaeological excavation. And yes, it was European run at the time. Remember, this is 1947. We're not talking, we've tried to write the story as, what would things be like in the world in 1947? And obviously it was a lot different. For instance, in 1947, Egypt had a king. Egypt was a monarchy. That was before the Islamic revolution in the 50s with, Nasser, that's when he became like a revolutionary. Egypt is now not a monarchy, but at 1947 it was. So we had to take that into consideration. We had to do a good bit of, you know, research into what was going on in Egypt and England and the United States in 1947. And it was a little bit different than it is now. And like we said, we wanted this to be a trilogy. So this is supposed to be the first book of a trilogy, which means, there's others, two more to come. And the plan is that with the other two, that that will bring us more into a contemporary time frame. It won't be 1947. That would be the first part of the trilogy. The second one would be more like, you know, basically our current time period of, you know, the 2024, you know. And then the third one would be even further in the future. So it set up a storyline like that. So, but right now we were just focusing on the first book, which was quite a Herculean task.
Yeah. And like I said, I mean, we really go into depth on how the feelings of Lot and his wife, and I won't read it, but if you read it, it's pretty emotional. Lot seeing his wife die and their conversation and him, you know, trying to get her to not look back. And we really go into detail about that. And then we, you know, so that's why we wanted to take all these parts from beginning of when these gods came and created the human race, and they're wanting to destroy us, and certain humans were saved and protected. And then, you know, we have other races involved, other alien races involved, and there's a battle going on for humans, and there's secret missions that are going on. And then we lead up into this 1947 era. And then from there, you know, we try and show the religiousness of what's similar to today and how the religious mind thinks about certain things and how it's hard to accept these, you know, things such as discoveries. If there was a discovery like this, you know, how would society react if it actually came to be that, you know, it's like in that movie Independence Day when they went down underneath this bunker and they saw that ship. Like, what if a ship like that was discovered and was put on display for the entire world to see, and that it was full disclosure? How would the world react to that? And but there are powers that be that keep this stuff behind closed doors because they don't want society to see or to know about this. And they may have their reasons. They may be good reasons. They may be selfish reasons. They may be, you know, not good intentions behind it. Who knows? But you know, but the next book is not for the faint of heart. And the third book, it's quite the battles that will be going on. And you know, but so we think that you guys will enjoy the book if you read it.
All right. Essentially, what we want to do is take the ancient astronaut theory and make it into a novel, make it something entertaining. And we did a lot of searching on that idea. We haven't come across anyone else who's done this, where they have written a book about ancient astronaut theory and sort of brought it into, you know, what would we do today if we found out that it was true? I think that's the question that a lot of us would like to, you know, find out. There's like all these episodes of ancient aliens on the History Channel, and you know, we've all seen those shows where they explain the possibility and what could be an explanation for some of these stories and mythology and in the biblical narrative. What if we found the actual piece that said, hey, it really did happen? What would it be like? And that's what we wanted this novel to be about. So,
Yeah. So, you know, we hope you check out Battle Planet AD, A Relic of the Gods, right, Joe?
Right. We think you'll enjoy it and find it very entertaining, maybe even a bit tantalizing. It is available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. The paperback is going for, what, $19.99, hardcover $24.99, and ebook $9.99 for both Amazon Kindle and Barnes & Noble Nook. Again, we're not peddling this. We're just telling you what the prices are. We're not, you know, we're not trying to, it's not a sales pitch. We just want to share, you know, our experience in writing the book, because it has been very time consuming over the last 5 years. Also, it is not on the shelves in any bookstore, at least not yet. You can only get it online. So thank you all for the support you've given us by listening to our podcast. And, you know, a big thank you to our lovely wives and our families for the encouragement you've given us while we were writing this book, and for being there for us during all the many hours that we had to spend on it, and the time that we had to take away from other things, you know, like all the things on the honey-do list. Can't spray the weeds today, my dear. I'm working on the book manuscript. But seriously, yeah, you're great, and we love you, and we couldn't have done this without you.
Yeah, that's for sure. So we've heard about how the American government may have been hiding UFO secrets for decades, that alien technology is being researched and reverse engineered out in Area 51. But could it also be that aliens themselves are a part of all of it? There are such stories about that very thing, and one of them is even said to have a name, and that name is Valiant Thor. Yes, it is the basis of a popular movie, but it also is thought by some people to be the name given to a real ET who has been to the Pentagon and the White House.
Yeah, it's a name associated with the Eisenhower administration, an alien being who came to Earth near Washington, D.C., demanded to see the president to speak about the concerns of his race, his alien race, about the future of our planet. And supposedly there are old photos of him. I've seen them. He looks pretty human. And while it is definitely the story material of many science fiction books and movies by that title, Valiant Thor, there have been some people claiming to have worked in the CIA who say he is real and he is an ET. So we'll dabble in that a little bit next time.
It kind of reminds me of that movie, The Day the Earth Stood Still. You know,
that came from the same era, yeah. 50s. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if he's still around, you know, like randomly wandering about the government facilities.
I think if we had an ET working with the government, things would actually be running more smoothly than they are.
Unless they're reptilians, Joe.
Well, either way, could use some higher intelligence, right?
Yeah, no kidding. So, once again, thank you all for tuning in today's episode. And please consider giving our novel a read. And we want to know what you think. So read it through and let us know your thoughts.
Yes, we would definitely love to know what you think of the book and our podcast show. And until then, until we're with you again here on Alien Talk Podcast, stay curious. Always.